used audio for my own data collection purposes. So
right. So we're both recording.
We're both recording. And yes, with that said, it sort of makes my next question moot that I've got your permission to use your name when reporting the results today.
Yeah. And for the people who are listening to the recording, this is Nicole Christian interviewing Stephen Downs. It's July 15th, 2013.
That's correct. And so I'm going to just start by, now this, just to give some background too for anyone who's listening, this is for my master's degree in educational technology that I'm doing through the University of British Columbia. And I'm basically doing a research project right now on the business of disruptive learning. And I'm just asking experts like Stephen in the field their perspectives on a number of questions regarding what's going on. So with that said, I'm going to just identify a few key terms that I'll use, and you can feel free just to clarify or challenge me on any of them, just to make sure we're on the same page.
Sure.
Okay. So the first term that I'm going to use, when I speak of disruption, I'm talking primarily of changes that are taking place that are threatening current educational and business models due to the increased open access to learning.
Okay.
So, I know these terms are somewhat ambiguous, so that's why I'm providing a definition. They kind of mean different things to different people.
Yeah.
When I speak of flexible learning initiatives, speaking in a very all-encompassing way, I'm speaking of MOOCs, obviously, which are receiving the most hype right now, but I'm also speaking of other learning initiatives that offer an alternative from traditional face-to-face classroom-based learning.
Okay.
And then open learning, when I'm speaking of that, I'm encompassing both the concept of open source, where the code is made available or materials are made available to people who can hopefully figure it out. But I'm also speaking, when I'm of open learning, to open access learning. And by that, I mean materials being made available to people at a level at which they understand and can be and can use.
That's a bit vague.
It is a bit vague, I know. It's a tough concept, and again, as we go on, if you want to specify and stuff and go a different angle, that is totally fine.
Sure.
So I'm going to get started with my questions. The first, in terms of online learning, so much of the emerging market seems in chaos at the moment, particularly with the hype surrounding MOOCs. Generally speaking, how would you describe the current state of disruption to someone who is wanting to launch an educational venture? And that's either a commercial venture or one that's institutionally based. And I'm sure you've got a fair amount to say on that.
Run away. I mean, that's a hard question. I mean, the first thing to keep in mind is the state of the technology and the state of the marketplace is changing rapidly. So solutions and market surveys that were current even a year or so ago probably aren't now. And you're not going to be able to get good data really on where things will be in 5 years because the present data won't point in any straightforward way to where things will be in 5 years. So you can't just launch a data-driven initiative or an evidence-based initiative. At a certain point, you're going to have to draw a line and say, here's where I think it's going. And it's not based on surveys or methodology. It's based on a deeper understanding of the technology, the trends, and even human nature. And you have to, if you will, plant your stake in the ground and go with it. I know that's not what business people like to hear because, they like to minimize risk, but it's a high-risk environment right now. There's so many moving parts or so many players from so many different domains. In one day, you could be acquired for hundreds of millions of dollars. The next day, a giant could move in and wipe out your marketplace. I mean, it's like that.
And then sort of along those lines, too, because it is such an upheaval right now, and there isn't that data, there isn't anything. I'd love to hear your opinion on sort of the history of this. Do you feel that this disruption has just begun, or is this something that's been ongoing for a while?
It's been ongoing for a while. It's been ongoing since the 90s, which is why it kind of interests me, people, to hear people say, you know, oh yeah, it's just started now. You know, look what learning management systems came out in 1995, 1996. In that space of 2 or 3 years, the entire education world was turned upside down because we went from not having internet to having internet. That was a huge disruption. Just as people were settling into that, we got Napster and Nutella and the whole concept of file sharing. MP3 comes along, and all of a sudden we don't have to use real media. Again, huge disruption. You look a few years later, we have really good video conferencing tools like Illuminate, Ustream, even Skype, Google Hangout. You know, huge disruption, and the stuff we couldn't do a few years before. So, you know, MOOCs are just the latest thing, and the only reason I think people think they're such a big disruption is because certain institutes with certain high-profile names have taken an interest in them. But that's not what makes something a disruption. That's what makes something newsworthy. Because, you know, people who write the news just love to put Harvard or MIT in their news stories. But the disruption's been going on forever, well, for the last 20 years.
So based on your story and with your, you know, history, like in terms of, you know, the original MOOCs and all of the sort of stuff that you've done in terms of open learning and flexible learning and whatnot, what do you feel is to come in this marketplace?
Well, we still haven't seen the impact of personal learning environments. This is something that we've been talking about since 2006. By we, I mean those of us who were originally involved in MOOCs and online learning before Harvard and Stanford took an interest in it. Personal learning environments are going to be, you know, could be significant. Because they shift the domain or the locus of learning from the institutional environment to the personal environment. This allows for, you know, a much more nuanced and much more textured resource infrastructure to be available to individuals. But it also shakes up the traditional patterns of content distribution, because now you don't have the bottlenecks that you used to have. So that's one thing. People talk a lot about learning analytics, and no doubt you hear that over and over in your research. Where learning analytics, I mean, there's two major types, and people have been mostly focused on prescriptive analytics, which will help you know when somebody's going to fail before they actually do that. But there's the other kind of analytics, I'm not sure what you'd call it, I don't know if it has a name, but it's a kind of analytics that analyzes a person's performance and is able to determine whether or not they've acquired a skill or a capacity. Let's call it summative analytics. So we'll have, you know, the analytics equivalent of formative and summative evaluation. And once we have something like summative analytics, the whole question of why we have tests and assignments and grades and credentials and degrees comes up, because we don't need that infrastructure anymore. It all becomes redundant because we just study a person's profile and we can tell. And that, you thought MOOCs were disruptive. This would be hugely disruptive. So those are just a couple of things, and I'm sure there are more things coming down the pipe.
And in the midst of this disruption with so many things, you know, I guess in a state of flux with all these new developments and stuff like that, what, if anything, do you feel has been proven so far in this emerging market?
What's been proven? what's been proven. You can send data from one place to another around the world. We know that now. It's possible to videotape a lecture and post it online. That sounds pretty trivial. You know, when I started, people were, you know, mid-1990s, people were saying, well, you can't do that. Best you could do is a little postage stamp size video, and nobody would ever want to watch that. Turns out they did want to watch it, and it turns out we could do that. But I imagine you're thinking of something a little more substantial. You know, I'm not even sure what counts as proven anymore. You know, we look a lot at, what works, quote unquote, in education. And when we're looking for something like that, we're looking for some sort of input and then some sort of reliably knowable output. But there isn't agreement on what the outputs are. Right now, the focus seems to be on test scores. Well, we just talked about tests. It's not even the leading indicator, and in the future it won't even be a relevant indicator, so who cares if e-learning produces test scores? So you have some sort of methods, such as, I forget what you call it, but the timed release, right? You show something, then you remind them, right? Which has very good results so far as retention goes, but is that learning? Is that producing the outcomes that we wanted, or that, you know, the person studying or learning by internet technologies, is that what they want? Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. A person wants to learn a language, say they want to become a proficient speaker of a language. Well, remembering the meaning of a word will help them, unless literal translations are not useful in this context, which is always. So, you know, I really hesitate when somebody says, well, what's proven? What's proven? The brain is filled with neurons. That's proven. What's proven? Connections between these neurons grow and atrophy with disuse, and that they change through a lifetime. This is known as the plasticity of mind. So that's known. That's, you know, what we know is along those lines. What's known, you can describe the settling of a set of connections using a set of thermodynamic equations known as the Boltzmann equations. That's known. So there's a relationship between thermodynamics and learning. We know that, but what does that mean? You see what I mean? There's a bit of a gap between what can we prove and what do we want to do.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit before, touched on like PLEs, and in terms of sort of that, in terms of future directions and stuff, where do you feel is the solid ground for further building?
The solid ground. I would start with the ground. No, I'm just kidding. I'm looking outside at, you know, grass and fields and trees and a lamppost with a cement base and it's the ground. What is the solid ground? The solid ground, I think, is the individual learner. And those two words are tricky words, individual and learner, because by individual I don't mean a person separated from all of existence. I don't mean some kind of Ayn Rand individualism. I mean a person who functions as a person in a society, who has friends and education and values and goals and employment and all the rest of it. That's what I mean by an individual. And by learner, I don't use the word learner as a shortcut for all manner of progressive education, but at the same time, I use the word rather than student because most learners, in fact, are not students. And if education has a weakness, it's in the focus on, quote-unquote, the student who is a person enrolled in a formal institution usually having had paid tuition of some sort, whereas in fact, the much wider population, which we call learners, is probably the base that we want to be appealing to. You know, people talk a lot about these days about lifelong learning. And, you know, on one hand, it's a slogan, but on the other hand, it's necessary for everyone in order to be able to adapt and adjust and cope with a rapidly changing society. So I think the base is the individual learner understanding that what we're about as educators is not, quote unquote, giving them an education, or as OECD said about OERs, giving learning for free, or any kind of depiction of learning as though it's a charity, or it's some kind of philanthropy, or even some kind of distribution system, wholesale market product. Learning is something that people do for themselves, and what we're up to in education is increasing a person's capacity in order to accomplish that learning for themselves according to their own needs, objectives, and goals, according to their own means. And we're not giving them anything. We're helping them do what they want to do.
So with that said, then, how might this trend towards, and because I do, you know, see that sort of people are moving it, I think a trend is a fair word to this, you know, individualized learning, how might this affect traditional educational channels, and what, if anything, may remain unaffected?
I'm not sure anything would affect traditional educational channels. We could have a thermonuclear war, and professors would show up the next day at university, and the students would be there, and it's like, wait 10 minutes, then leave. More scenarios, Earth colliding with the moon, class still on. We're talking about very large, very well-funded, especially in the U.S. I mean, you've got universities with an endowment of $1 billion. They're probably not going to change a whole lot, no matter what happens. On the other hand, we're already seeing public universities or state-supported universities that are groaning, searching for funds. Somebody told me about a public state-funded university, I think it was in Minnesota, that went from 40% public funding down to 7%. At that point, you can't even consider that to be a government-funded institution anymore. It's something, but it's not that. And we're seeing increased pressure on that end. There's going to be a lot more pressure to lower the cost of providing an education. And I think especially the public or quasi-public institutions are going to have to respond in some form. I think that more, though, we're going to see many alternatives spring up outside the system. And I think we're already beginning to see that. They call themselves universities sometimes. Everything from McDonald's University to Diversity University to OER University and all the rest in between. And none of them are actual universities. But they do provide an alternative means of gaining some learning, some kind of credential. And we talked about credentials. But more importantly, some sort of access to an employment market or some other way of obtaining a value from an education. That's going to become more and more important. People don't realize, it's only in the last few years, maybe the last 5 years, that the bulk of human knowledge has become available on the internet for everybody on the planet. Not everybody, there's a couple billion at the bottom missing, but these days that's a rounding error. So all of a sudden, there's hundreds of millions of people in India, Indonesia, China, Malaysia, and the rest who are able to access, okay, not Harvard classes and MIT classes, but the same content, right? The same stuff. And they're not going to benefit from what Harvard and MIT and that sell, and that's access to an elite, network of people who help each other and inhabit positions of high, positions of power and status. But they'll form their own networks. They are forming their own networks. They have formed their own networks, and they'll establish their own centers of power in their own way. This is a tectonic shift. This is a shift from, a group of maybe a few hundred thousand people run in the corridors of power to a group of a few hundred million. Well, you can't change, that amount of power without it having dramatic shifts. I mean, look what happens in a country when all you do is educate women. You dramatically change the society, right? If you go from 1% of the people are educated to 50% of the people are educated, you can't run your society the same way anymore. They just won't put up with it. I wouldn't put up with it. So there are going to be dramatic shifts. And as these people outside the traditional institutions gain more and more power, the traditional institutions, and especially the state-run institutions, become less and less relevant. And ultimately, we stop funding them, because why would we fund institutes that generally benefit rich people anyways? Why not just put our money into open online learning that anyone can access? It costs us less to do that. People who are motivated can teach themselves, and rich people can pay for themselves whatever they want. Who cares? And that's the future I think we're looking at. University professors hate it because, the major, they're the people who would suffer the most of the cost. And, this is why they're scrambling now, especially the elite institutions, to preserve their reputations and to put a stake in the ground, saying, we're still here, we teach, remember? Other institutions are scrambling to become predominantly research institutions, associate themselves with a company or with an industry. And you've seen that historically with places like Waterloo in Canada and Stanford in the United States, and we'll see more and more of that. And others will be amalgamated, will fold, will gradually close their doors or gradually convert into some sort of online institution or something that just certifies their credentials that were earned elsewhere. That's going to be very disruptive. But I think in the long run, it's going to be better for people if we keep it public, if we maintain public support for open online learning. If we turn around and say, well, we don't need the education system anymore, we'll just have publishers produce contents that you can access online, then we'll have destroyed the system without having it replaced with something of equal value, and that would be a disaster. That's a recipe for going back to the world of 1% gets an education and everybody else gets nothing. And that too would have social consequences.
So my final question, and you've touched on it quite a bit here, so if you have anything sort of new or sort of different to add to it, the last question is sort of two parts. What are the risks and potential benefits to becoming an early adopter of open learning ventures? And what are the risks and benefits of waiting until a proven model emerges?
Yeah, there are no proven models. So that's the risk of waiting is that you never get started. Yeah, and that's what places like Harvard did, right? They were just sitting there waiting. Let's wait for the best practices and we'll do that. And they never came. it depends. I'm thinking now about being an early adopter. And how early an adopter you are depends on how competent you are. And if you know what you're doing, then you should adopt as early as possible, because you actually become one of the people who shapes the direction of the field, and you can shape it into either your own interests or the interests of society or whatever. The risk, though, is if you become an early adopter and you're not competent, you get yourself in trouble, in over your head, if you will. Think of computer operating systems, right? Think of Windows. Right now, most people are running, Windows XP. They're pretty comfortable with that. The people waiting for a proven system are still on Windows 95. and they only went there because Microsoft stopped supporting Windows 3.1. The sort of early adopters are the people who had to buy a new computer on Windows 8, I guess it is, Windows 7 or Windows 8. People who are even more early adopters are on Windows 8.1, which is supposed to be much better than Windows 8, although I haven't seen it yet. No problem. If you're testing Windows 9, and I'm sure some people are, a lot of stuff doesn't work, and you need to be able to develop your own workarounds, right? You go to print something, it'll say printer not found because you have no printer drivers. So you need to be able to configure a printer driver and install it. If you can do that, great, because you're one of the people on Windows 9. When you send a message to Microsoft, they're listening, and they'll fix the system. You said printer drivers enough. Oh, yeah, I guess we better put in some printer drivers. Okay, that's a bad example, but you know what I mean.
Yes, yeah.
So it really depends, right? Generally, you should be as early an adopter as you can, because you gain benefit of knowledge and influence, but you have to be careful not to go further than you can, because then you just end up, blowing up your computer.
That makes a lot of sense. So that's it for me in terms of questions. Do you have any additional insights or anything that you feel tie into this that weren't covered in the questioning?
I'm still hung up on what's proven. COBOL is a dead language. Perl is more efficient than PHP. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. Not really. I was going to say this field, but pretty much any technology-related field is still a pretty interesting place to be. It's a moment in history, and people forget that. When I was a kid, which isn't that long ago, longer than I might like, but it isn't that long ago, people were doing this kind of stuff with radios and transistors, and that was the technology, and that's when we had the CB craze. There were like crystal radio kits, and you could build your own radio, and people were really experimenting with that. 40 years before then, the technology was the internal combustion engine. And people were messing around with that, right? Not just the internal combustion, it's just engines, right? And you'd go to the hardware store and you'd buy an engine and you'd bring it home and you'd see all the different things you could do with your engine, right? You'd use it to mix stuff. You'd use it to sweep the floor. You'd use it to power a fan. You'd make a car out of it, whatever. And the people who worked on and built those engines were then like the people who work on and build computers, computer programmers today. And 50 years from now, computer designers, builders, programmers are going to be like the people who build, or people who work on cars today, right? We think of that as trades. You know, I think of it as technology, which is what it is, right? But, you know, the line between trades and technology is really fine. So it's pretty easy to say, well, you know, this is going to be everything, and this is where the future is, right? But the future probably isn't in this. If I was talking to an 18-year-old, and he, like me, back in 1978, 1980, if he was looking for a career, I'd say, well, yeah, try not computers. You know, computers, they pretty much mastered that. You're going to have to study for 10 years just to get to the basics. That's how complex it's gotten. And a lot of people will do that, you know, make good livings. But if you really want, you know, to be on the cutting edge of something, of what's going to be disruptive in your lifetime as opposed to my lifetime, I'd look at carbon, carbon nanotubes, carbon capacitors, you know, custom DNA, custom RNA, you know, carbon memory systems, that kind of thing. There's, you know, right now we call them ambiguously life sciences, but I think of it more broadly as just carbon-based science. Not organic chemistry, that's something different. But you know, carbon-based electronics, carbon-based information systems, and so on. That's where the future will be. You know, we're approaching an age, you know, 20, 30 years ago, where batteries, this is a battery, and this battery will run your car all day. Well, it's not really a battery because it doesn't generate power, but as a capacitor, it can store a day's worth of power. And we'll generate that power with nuclear reactors or windmills or tidal power or solar or whatever. So, you know, imagine that kind of world. And so, you know, it's easy to get caught up in, you know, everything that's happening now is so disruptive. It's just a moment, and the moments pass. So that would be my final word.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Again, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate getting your insights and all your answers here. That's been a huge help to me, so thank you.
Great. Well, that's what I wanted to do.
Fabulous. All right. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.